You're listening to Peel Talks Housing, the Region of Peel's podcast delving deep into complex issues around affordable housing and homelessness and efforts to help residents get and keep housing. Episodes will feature residents with lived experience, Region of Peel staff, our partners, academics, policymakers, and other leading voices in the affordable housing sector. The opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the individuals expressing them and may not reflect the opinions of the Region of Peel or the direction provided by the Region of Peel's Council. This episode of Peel Talks Housing contains a sensitive subject matter that may not be suitable for all audience members. Viewer and listener discretion is advised.
Hey everybody, my name is Axel Villamil and I'm your host for Peel Talks Housing. Today we'll be focusing on the topic of human sex trafficking and impacts on housing. We're here joined by three amazing guests. We have Misha Maloney, we have Leanne Bailey, and Sam McNeil. How are you doing today?
How about you?
Good. Good. Would love for you to all introduce yourselves, tell us about what you do, and also why you wanted to participate in this podcast.
My name is Misha. I'm a community auntie, an educator, community worker, have been doing this work for over 10 years now, and I'm also a survivor of sex trafficking, both domestic and internationally. And the reason why I want to be part of this podcast is because I think it's really important to show, what survivors need for safe housing, and also those intersections of being Black and Indigenous and what those impacts are on housing as well.
Thanks, Misha.
I'm Leanne Bailey. I'm the manager of anti-human trafficking programs and services for the agency Elizabeth Fry Society of Greater Toronto. In my portfolio, I oversee and supervise the Safe House Bonnie McPhee, as well as the Peel Transition House, which are both designated residences to survivors to access housing, as well as I supervise the outreach team in those communities, where I have a team of six that support individuals that identify as victims, survivors of trafficking and exploitive situations in the region of Peel.
And I'm Samantha McNeil. I am the advisor of the Peel Anti-Human Sex Trafficking Strategy. And my work as a nurse, I've been involved in engaging with marginalized populations my whole career, over 21 years. And I am also a sexual assault and domestic violence nurse examiner. So I bring the health side and the nursing side of this issue, as well as the government side of things as my advisor role.
Amazing. Thank you. You have a lot of experience there, Samantha. Well, you've been telling me to call you Sam. But one of the great things, that you have is that this experience to talk about to the rest of the audience who may not know exactly what human sex trafficking actually is and who's affected by it. So would love if you could explain that for us.
Absolutely. So I'm not one to read, but for the Criminal Code of Canada definition, I will, just to be on the safe side to make sure I'm not missing anything. So the Criminal Code of Canada defines human trafficking as the recruitment, transportation, transfer, receipt, holding, concealing, harboring a person, or exercising of control, direction, or influence over the movements of a person for the purpose of exploiting them or facilitating their exploitation. So in addition to that, human sex trafficking involves the force, deception, or coercion of another person into sex for money. So in a nutshell, it's somebody that is being duped into it, not knowing about it, as well as individuals that are being coerced. Oftentimes, people are not aware that they're being trafficked initially, and I'm sure we'll get into that in a little bit more detail. But that's really the primary issue here, is that it can happen in plain sight. And I think that by virtue of doing this podcast, it brings awareness to the issue and also helps people understand what the red flags are to help support individuals that are being trafficked. We do know that the majority of individuals, about 63% of the population that are engaged in this course of crime, that are trafficked into Ontario are Canadian citizens. So it's not something that's happening across the world. Primarily, it is individuals that are born and raised in Canada that are being trafficked in Canada. And definitely, it is a crime that's gender-based. So we know that approximately 97% of individuals that are being trafficked for sex are girls and women. And I think the main point that I want to leave this question on is that the primary risk factor for being sex trafficked is being a girl.
This is, elephant in the room. This is a very tough topic, you know, to talk about. And, you know, I want to thank all of you here to start discussing it, because like you said, it's a very important conversation to have. As Sam went through that definition, does anybody have any thoughts on that?
It always makes me sad to know that just identifying as a female makes you more susceptible to this crime. It is gender-based violence. I think that the trauma and that the individual's face leaves you with, why do we want to be involved? How could you not? Right? After you hear their stories, their resilience, their strength is something that, as someone who has worked with these individuals for many years, continue to be in awe from. It is happening in our communities. If we don't have a response, then if not us, then who? And if not now, then when? Right?
Totally. And, hearing that definition, one thing that I always stress as well, yes, it's a gender-based violence issue, but we should never leave boys and young men or men out of the conversation, because I feel like over the years, because we're not speaking about them, we're not making space for them, you know? So that's something that I do like to stress as well, is, you know, yes, it's happening to female identifying folks, but it's also happening to men as well and young boys.
Absolutely. And I think it's, you know, the stats are obviously there. And I think one, you know, showing that fact about men, but also at the same time, men to step up and realize that this is, you know, a huge issue and we should look out, you know, for our fellow women out there or who identify as fellow women. Now, this goes back to you, Sam, is people may think that living in poverty influences women and girls to get into trafficking. Is that true?
It definitely increases your vulnerability. So we can't ask someone to leave unless we know that we have a safe place for them to live. Oftentimes, basic needs are not being met. And therefore, if you are homeless, being provided some a shelter, possibly some food, really, and in speaking with survivors, that's really been the situation, is individuals have said, although I was trafficked in a hotel room, this was better than being on the street and being in a situation where I might be beat up or robbed. And so that's not a good feeling, to know that we are leaving individuals that are incredibly vulnerable in a situation where they have to choose between living on the street or being trafficked. And those are the options. So definitely having this conversation today is so important, by virtue of the fact that, individuals who are living in poverty are definitely overrepresented in the victims and survivors and those at risk. But it's not to say that that's the only individual. And I think to Misha's point, we do speak a lot about the individuals that are overrepresented. However, we have to also identify that it could be an individual from any walk of life, from any socioeconomic background, from any sociodemographic. So I think that's really important, because oftentimes if you stay in that space, like you say, you don't make space for others. And therefore, they feel invisible, that maybe their experience is not identified. But as well, that individuals will turn their head and say, well, it's only individuals that are in foster care, or it's only individuals who are living on the street. And that's absolutely not the case.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I heard that trafficking lure victims in by selling false promises and all these things that you've been explaining, lying about work conditions and stuff like that. Is that the case all the time, that this is the lifestyle that they're trying to promise these victims?
Definitely. I mean, like I say, there's a lot of individuals that are duped into it, that don't know that they're getting involved in a situation that will become coercive and abusive. Many individuals will lure their victims by virtue of false pretenses, saying that they'll buy them things, or that they're their boyfriend, and posing as their boyfriend and showing them affection and love and a lot of material things. And then there comes a time where the individual will say, you know, did you think this was all for free? It wasn't. You have two options. You can either go and be in a strip club and, you know, make $1,000 a day before you're allowed to leave, or you can pay off your debt through escorting, and there would be a limit of amount of money before they would be allowed to leave. It can get definitely more it can become more coercive over time as well. And it's not only individuals where it's a man that is posing as a boyfriend or as a friend. There are individuals that are female traffickers as well, and that falls under the radar even further. And Misha, when we've had conversations, and Misha can definitely, if you feel comfortable providing that experience, because I think that that's absolutely true, where traffickers will put individuals in positions where they feel like, you know, no one will notice.
Exactly. And for myself, like my first trafficker was female. And the first time I met her, you know, she was lovely. She took me to a makeup store that I've never been into. And she spent like $300 on me and made me feel so special. And, you know, that's when the grooming process started to happen. And my first day of, I guess you could say, working, you know, I was met with a photographer, and all the other girls were there, and they were like encouraging me to, like, you know, model in like lingerie and being in positions that I wasn't really comfortable in. But, you know, when you have a room of like 12 girls and they're all around your age, you know, you think like, okay, this is normal, I guess. So, yeah, like it was a completely different experience than what my pimp at the time, you know, told me about. You know, she said, like, we're like sisters here, we take care of each other. And then it all changed, you know, and she's like, remember that photo shoot? Remember that hairstylist? Remember that makeup artist? Oh, you have to pay me back, you know? So definitely, to Sam's point, it's like a complete switch of what you're expecting.
Absolutely. I mean, it like you said, bait and switch, you know, type of situation here. I mean, for you, you know, how did it get to the point where they could take advantage of that? So were you vulnerable already in that state of mind? And that's how they, you know, went on to target vulnerabilities and use those things like makeup and those promises to get you in the door.
Yeah. So the first day I met her, you know, she was asking me like, what are some of my goals? You know, and I told her, and, you know, I told her I was in university at the time, and, you know, I was broke, you know? So like now that I'm out and I look back, it's like I could see that she was like taking notes, like, okay, so what can I pull on later on, you know? So I'm telling her, you know, I didn't have a good relationship with my parents. Telling her, you know, yeah, I kind of felt alone. Yeah, I'm looking for money, you know. No, I didn't feel like as pretty at the time. And like, she pulled on all of those things. So I was definitely very vulnerable. And she used all my vulnerabilities like against me.
Do you think a lack of housing increases vulnerability? And how does the availability of housing options increase the rate of success, you know, for exit?
I can only speak of my story. At the time, I was living in a really crappy basement apartment, you know, covered in mold, with a roommate I wasn't too fond of, you know, and I knew I wanted to leave, and I told this to her as well. So sometimes, you know, she would have me work extra with different clients so I could, I guess you could say, like, pay off the room for the night. So not only did this happen to me, but a few of the other girls were in really crappy housing situations. So definitely housing plays a part. And like Sam was saying, that I did have to choose between either living in this really crappy basement apartment, or, you know, maybe a couple times a night I would be at really expensive hotels, you know. And like Sam was also saying, there were times where our pimp, I'll say our because I'm thinking of the other girls, she would starve us. But, you know, little glimpses of hope where she would like give us like really expensive food, like that was nice. And it was almost like she would show us love and then take it away, and then show us love again, and we would get really happy, and we're like, okay, so we can see what like she can possibly be like, you know, and maybe more of this can happen. But then she would take it away. So definitely, like, housing, just all those vulnerabilities can play a factor.
Absolutely. Now, this question is directed to you, Leanne. Is it hard to believe that human trafficking is happening in our communities? Like, is it hard to think that it's happening at Peel?
Well, it may be hard to think of, but I can tell you that it is happening in Peel. I think that, you know, there's obviously, like we just, you know, touched on vulnerabilities in individuals. If you look at the community or the region of Peel, it is easily accessible for traffickers to traffic girls up and down because of the access to the 400 series highways that are a touch away. I also know, you know, in Peel, there's a huge population of individuals that fit that age gap and, you know, that identifies female. So that makes it, you know, more prevalent in that region. And I think to touch on what Misha was saying, when you're looking at trafficking and housing in Peel, like that, it's, you know, the sheer population speaks to that vulnerability because more people are struggling with that. And we know that through statistics and data and just what's happening out there. I mean, just put yourself in that option where for most of us, even though we feel overwhelmed on the daily, we don't need to worry about where we're going to sleep tonight. Mm-hmm. These individuals do.
Absolutely.
And I often hear many stories about the choices that they have and understand every day how overwhelming it must be to not know how you're going to keep yourself safe today. So in Peel, that is a reality, unfortunately. And I can tell you that, yes, it is happening.
Are these actually reported as well as you think they should be? Like, are you?
No, and like you know, yeah, you sure. Can talk about data and stats, and that is an important piece because it does educate and teach us things. But keep in mind that this topic is completely underreported, and you know, Misha was talking about male identified. That's even more underreported for reasons such as judgment and shame about coming forward, about the individual's trauma and previous experiences that they may have had with law enforcement or other systems, healthcare system, or other experiences they may have had, even in shelter. You can offer them a shelter, but that's not nowhere that they would like to go because of the trauma that they've experienced as a result of that. So it does speak to that issue of underreported. Why would they report? And they will say that to you if you spend some time with them.
It's you know, you bring up the male portion, and it's I've actually only heard about that when I had, as a friend of a friend, let me know about their situation. And I think, you know, you're very right. It's that if not even the higher statistic of females are being reported than the males at all not being reported is even crazier to think that that's really unfortunate. And I think there, you know, needs to be something done about that. So I'm glad we're having this conversation.
Yeah. And you know what, Axel, like back to your question, like we do a lot of community engagements, educating the public in Peel about what's happening. And I remember this kind gentleman who was with a financial institution. It was like a give back kind of thing. And we talked about what sex trafficking is and what's happening in the region of Peel. And he was very concerned. And he looked at me and he said, like, well, what does it look like? So I know. And then I said, it doesn't really look like anything. It's two girls looking at a phone in the mall. It's a bus stop. It's, you know, a schoolyard. And I think that can shock people, but that is the reality. What does it look like? It doesn't really look like one thing.
And they can look like anything.
Yeah, you know what I mean? In absolutely. Terms of
like, are you on like, you have nice clothes, you have, you know, not nice clothes. And it's just all ranges. So you really can't tell. But it exists out there.
Yeah.
And that's the point here that we got to really talk about. This question is back to you, Sam. There aren't many regional governments directly involved in this issue. So the region of Peel seems very committed to being part of the solution. Can you expand on this?
Sure, absolutely. So I think there's a role to play for private, public, multi-sectoral organizations in engaging in the work of human sex trafficking and anti-human sex trafficking specifically, obviously. So in 2017, the Peel Human Trafficking Service Providers Committee came to our regional council and delegated to our regional council to really raise the issue of two very distinct gaps in service, one being trauma counseling or the lack thereof and lack of housing. And regional government definitely took that to heart and wanted to make sure that we looked at opportunities to engage with our service providers and experts. And so we took it internally and we did quite an extensive environmental scan with service providers and survivors and experts in the field, both locally across Ontario, across Canada, and internationally. We really wanted to make sure that we were engaging best practices and the voices of survivors, as that is definitely something that we feel very important about, that we feel that is very important, to engage survivors in every piece of the work that we do. And so therefore, after that environmental scan, we were able to look at a framework and what a framework would be to address this issue. And so the framework that we arrived on has three pillars. The first is prevention. And that's, again, engaging all the experts in the field to raise awareness about this issue in Peel and beyond. We're very lucky to have a very healthy service providers committee of over 40 organizations. And they represent legal health, social services, education, various different sectors. And they definitely are the ears on the ground relating to the expertise and bringing that back. So when the experts came to us to say these are the gaps, we wanted to make sure that we engaged them as well. So as part of the prevention pillar, it's making sure that the awareness is built. And internally, we felt as the Region of Peel, we couldn't go out and tell everybody else what to do unless our organization understood what this was and how to better our services to make them more accessible to survivors. So we've done an e-learning module that has been shared across the corporation, as well as frontline service training. And Leanne is definitely one of our experts that supports that work in engaging Ontario Works caseworkers, Children's Services caseworkers, as well as our housing workers. So really to help individuals get a better sense of how they play a part in disrupting this system. We know that we can't end human sex trafficking, but we can definitely disrupt it. And the more eyes and the more ears on it, we're going to be able to work together to make it more difficult for traffickers to do what they do. And the Service Providers Committee does that out in the community. So with schools, with parent groups, with private corporations, with faith-based organizations. And the second pillar is interventions. And what that is bringing about organizations that currently provide services and are funded to do this service into one place with core services such as trauma counseling and case management, client navigation and system navigation. And so to the end user and the individual that's engaging in the services, it's very seamless, it's very coordinated, and it's comprehensive. So somebody doesn't have to travel across the region or across Ontario possibly to access services that they need. It's very much walking with them and identifying what their needs are and what their goals are, and meeting those goals by virtue of the various different service providers we have engaging, as well as maybe there's a service we don't have yet. Maybe there's a service we don't know somebody wanted, and then developing a rapport with that organization to ensure that their services are trauma-informed and that they're delivering them in a way that is very survivor-centric. The last pillar is our housing and exits pillar. And with EFRI's help and expertise, they're the lead organization in procuring that service with Bonnie McPhee, which is our safe house, as well as our Peel Transitional House. And that is, again, we can't ask people to leave their situation without having safe, secure, reliable housing options that are dedicated to individuals who are victims and survivors of human sex trafficking, and ensuring that it's low barrier so that we can have and understand that there will be individuals that cycle through in and out. But it's not a three strikes, you're out rule. It's meeting people where they're at.
Absolutely. Talking to the victims, speaking to them, and manufacturing plans that actually help them. That's great that Peel's doing that. It's not the ivory tower thing, like you said, that, you know, we think we know what we're doing. Now let's talk to everybody and get that done. But Leanne, you know, we're mentioning EFRI a lot. One of the questions we had is, as the lead organization, Peel, operating these two safe houses, can you speak more in detail about their structure and services? And from your experience, what are some good safe housing practices?
Sure. So I think, you know, in going back to what Sam said, I think that when we look at how we work with survivors, it's meeting them where they are at. So it's structured but flexible, and structured but individualized. It's not a one size fits all. It's not a tryout for this program. It's not, are you appropriate for the program? It's more, is the program appropriate for you? And if not, how can we work with you? What are your goals? I think one thing is to always, you know, ensure, and I talk to the staff all the time, you need to listen to the survivor. Your goals are not her goals. So what are her goals? And can this program help her accomplish those goals? And it's an open dialogue, and you're very transparent. You're consistent. You keep safety at the forefront for her, for the other girls in the program, for your community, for the staff, for everyone. And you're very honest about what it may look like. You know, gone are the days. I think Misha, you and I were talking, it's like, you're not going to come and rescue me. Like, that's not what they're looking for. And what they're looking for is this going to be safe? Is this going to work for me? And we need to get to know them. So, you know, we break it down into phases just to give you an idea. So orientation, what does that look like for you? What's going to happen when you get there? You know, the things that maybe some may stranger are different questions that, do I get my own room? Can I do this? Can I have this with me? Can I bring my dog? What about my cell phone? What does that look like? What would you do if my trafficker came looking for me? All those kinds of questions, wherever they come from, it's based on their experiences. So we want to make sure that we go through that during screening. We provide them information about, is this a good fit for me? So they can check off those boxes. We talk to them about short-term goals, long-term goals, even before we, you know, have a conversation about them attending the residence, right? Is this going to work? And there's no judgment or shame in either decision that they choose to make, right? We're very honest about some of the rules that, due to safety, we have to have. We talk to them about why those rules are in place. That's a huge piece. Just don't come and give them all this set of oppressive rules and they don't understand why. We have an open dialogue with each survivor to ensure that this is going to be a good decision. Right? And it's more of a, let's see how we do. You're not locked up in here. You're not going to lose anything by coming here. And it's just continuation and just really listening to them and what they want.
Yeah, listening is, you're right. It's not a one size fits all solution, but at the same time, you got to accommodate and work with everybody. But I think this next question is still for you, but I definitely think it's more of everybody here to talk, but how does safe housing play a critical role in the stabilization and eventual reintegration to society for trafficked victims and survivors?
So the housing is a big piece, right? Like, we touched on that, how important shelter is. It is a shelter, but it is more of a treatment program, right? So some of the challenges that our survivors face, such as mental health challenges, substance abuse challenges, issues related to the extreme trauma they have faced, how are we going to keep them safe and how are we going to support them through that, right? So I think with that, it's 16 to 24. Now, some people say to me, well, why is that? Because through data and research, to house 35 and 40-year-olds with a 16-year-old is not best practice for this. And Misha, you know, touched on that she had another female recruit her. That is a reality, unfortunately, that we need to be mindful, that we need to discuss with individuals in the residence, that location confidentiality. It's not, we don't want traffickers to know where these girls are. There is some severe safety risk for those individuals. And we talk to them about that, you know, it might not just be you, but it could be the girl in the room next to you. And if someone asks you where you're going, and we talk through, what are you going to say? What is that going to look like? They create their own experience. They work on their own goals, and that becomes a priority for them as well. There is a safe house, which we're really looking to stable and just kind of exhale and let's just figure out the next step without any pressure. And then, you know, for the transition house, you have those individuals who are further along in the journey, who have met some of those goals, who are kind of in a better place and looking for a little bit more room to transition into their own independence, right? Whether they're going to stay in Peel or move or school or some of those longer term goals.
Yeah. And one thing I can appreciate, like, hearing these programs as a survivor, I wish these programs were available to me, you know, because there were points that I was seeking help. And at the time, I didn't know I was being pimped out, but I was like, you know, I have a really crappy friend. You know, I'm working at this place. I don't really like it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people didn't take me seriously. And another thing that I can appreciate both of you saying is, you know, meeting people where they're at, and also not imposing your goals onto someone else. Because thinking of housing, like, I could not focus on other things if I didn't know where I was sleeping, and not only where I was sleeping, but knowing that my place was safe, you know? So also, I always say that it is fundamentally unfair to ask someone who's being trafficked to leave their trafficker if you're not able to meet their basic needs. And sometimes basic needs can mean, like, do you have money to pay for my substances? Because I use every week, you know, and having that lens available. I guess, like, also hearing this, my only worry is, you know, what happens if someone is 25, you know? And that's where I think we're missing people, because there are folks who are 25, 26 who are also being trafficked, you know? My first pimp, she was 27 when I met her. And, you know, she was also pimped out. But in her words, she was saying, you know, my boyfriend helped me, you know, look at our condo now, like, we're living the life. But now that I'm older and I'm out of the game and I can see it from the outside, it's like, no, she was also a victim too, you know? So it's like, if those services were available to her, would she continue, like, recruiting other girls, you know? And a point that Leanne made earlier is that, you know, trafficking can look all sorts of ways. And I think of, you know, my story, where there were times where I would be downtown with my school bag, you know, over my back, and then a purse full of, like, lingerie and toys and stuff. And, like, no one knew what was happening. And my pimp would, you know, pick me up right after class, drop me off, you know, before another class. And this was my routine for most of my university life. So yeah, it's a complex issue, but I'm glad to hear that work is being done, you know. And when it comes to transitional housing and, you know, involving survivors, like, it's amazing to hear. I just wish, you know, for myself, I wish those opportunities were, like, given to me or to people that look like me as well, because we don't hear about them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Misha, you know, victims of human trafficking often don't seek that help. Like you said, there's a lack of trust. You've been through so much. How did you feel about actually getting help? You know, when you did, what point did you decide to leave?
So my leaving story is a bit unique. So I had a bad date. I had told my driver at the time that I didn't want to work for the rest of the night. And he's like, okay. And he kicked me off in the middle of the highway, close to the border. So that was me leaving the game. Afterwards, you know, I thought I was doing all the right things. I thought I was ready. So, you know, I moved, I changed my number. And first thing I did was go seeking therapy. And I wasn't ready. I was ashamed, feeling that, you know, I was like, what's wrong with me? The fact that I don't want to go to therapy. I'm like, did I enjoy this? Because I know I feel like I didn't, you know, but I just wasn't ready to share. So it took a few years of not going to therapy to meet those basic needs, mostly by myself, but some folks did help me along the way. And then when I was ready to get those services, like, I went to them. A lot of the services that I was a part of were cultural. So they were Indigenous services that helped me not only connect back with my culture, but had a lens that I understood. Because a lot of the time, these services, not all of them, but some of these services are very Eurocentric, and they don't understand what it's like to be an Indigenous woman or a Black woman or Black person, Indigenous person, you know, accessing these services. Like, I remember I was doing a speech for a transitional house, and I asked them, I was like, okay, this is amazing. Do you allow your clients to smudge their room? Because that's important to us, you know? And they're like, no, because that can start a fire. And I was like, well, then, you know, like, it's great, but it could be better, you know?
Yeah.
So.
Absolutely. I think I want to bring this last question for everybody is thinking of prevention and creating awareness. What type of conversations should parents, caregivers, and schools have with your young girls and boys?
Again, I can only speak of my experience. So my mother is a part of law enforcement. So, you know, I would say that for parents, the first thing they have to do is take care of themselves. Because if they do not take care of themselves, they can put that onto their children, even if it's unintentional. You know, I left my mother's home at 17, you know, and our relationship is a lot better now. But at the time, I was looking for love in all the wrong places. And that's what made me vulnerable. So, yeah, one of the first things, parents, caregivers, please take care of yourself first. And also, you know, educating yourself of what HT can look like, you know. When I think of prevention, you know, in our schools, in the places that young people access, community centers, you know, even in malls, like, are you making safe spaces or safer spaces, I should say, for folks if they feel like this is happening to them, that they can, you know, come and seek help. So when it comes to prevention, it starts with education. It starts with taking care of each other. And, you know, keeping an open mind and keeping an open heart to help folks on their healing journey.
Yeah, I think that to Misha's point, you know, youth empower youth, right? So firstly, for parents and caregivers, you need to recognize that to empower your children in making those choices. You're right. It might never happen to your child, but it might happen to the person sitting next to them. And you could be an ambassador and you could really make a difference for them. And there's a high, it's very important for youth to have a high level of awareness of trafficking and exploitative situations so they can watch out for them and know what it looks like or what it could look like, you know? And I think that's important to Misha's point. They need people that look like them. When I talk about the houses, I could tell you all about the program, but it's never as impactful to someone who's actually been in the program. And that is huge. And you need to listen to youth. You need to listen to survivors. You need to talk to them about their experiences. You need to learn from your mistakes and, you know, you need to do better. I know myself and my agency and my staff are committed to collaborating, working with BIPOC agencies and specific services to be better able to support. And, you know, you're always thinking of justice, equity, diversity, inclusion in everything that you do. And I think youth have a role in that with each other.
Yeah, absolutely. I can't agree more with both of you. I think that you've definitely covered it. One other thing I would say is that for parents, caregivers, educators to not turn a blind eye, it is in plain sight. And to understand that it could happen to anyone. It's not a one type of person. It's not a cookie cutter situation. So I think oftentimes people want to think, well, that's not going to happen to me. That's terrible, but it's not going to happen to my family, to my friends, to my nieces. And so that's the one thing is become educated about, you know, what are the risk factors and who could potentially be lured into this. The other thing too is being able to have these dialogues. They're difficult dialogues to have. I think with regards to youth, I mean, we, again, going back to stats that are super underreported, but the average age of entry is about 12 and a half, and the average age of somebody being entrenched is 17. And we know with adolescents and youth that they don't like to be duped. They don't like to be tricked. They don't like to, you know, they know what where it's at, right? What everything is. So when you talk to an individual saying, you know, you just have to have your feelers out. You got to be aware. If it's a friend, it's somebody that's making you feel like it's too good to be true or whatever the case may be, make sure that you're being critical, not to the point where you can't go anywhere and you can't, you know, you're always fearful of who you're talking to. But at the same time, it's, you never want to be tricked. And I think that that is one piece that adolescents and youth really do respond to. They don't respond to, don't do this, don't do that, don't, you know, there's a lot of societal norms. Well, I wish you wouldn't have worn the short skirt. I wish you would have drank, wouldn't have drank. Well, no, you know, that might be coming to from a nice place, but no, we don't use that. That's not going to work. We know that. But ensuring that individuals are not being duped or not being tricked, I think is one way of getting to young people and helping them to understand and also advocate for their friends.
Absolutely. Awareness, inclusion, diversity, safe spaces, and, you know, most importantly, just taking care of each other is such a huge part. And as much as this was a difficult topic to talk about, it's probably the most needed topic to talk about because it is difficult. So I want to thank you all for your amazing, amazing info and time and sharing your stories and being vulnerable. This wraps our episode for Peel Talks Housing. I would like to thank Sam McNeil, Leanne Bailey, and most importantly, Michelle Maloney. Thank you so much for your amazing stories and input. You can find information on our podcast on peelregion.ca, and you can also join the conversation on the Region of Peel's social media accounts. The opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the individuals expressing them and may not reflect the opinions of the Region of Peel or the direction provided by the Region of Peel's Council.